Hollywood ever gets round to making a series of films out of the letters of John, which, okay, I think is unlikely, then the tagline for the final letter will be "Three John." This time it's personal. Because John has moved from the letter to the church to a more personal communication. And in doing so, he's going to name names. Just a few names that will be immortalized for all time in the scripture. Two goodies to be commended, and one name to be remembered in shame and disgrace. 3 John is your classic good, bad, good sandwich. One baddie sandwiched between two goodies. John begins writing to his friend Gaius, who is very definitely a goodie. John refers to himself in the letters as the elder, maybe a statement of his age, or maybe his role, or both. "The elder," is John, "to my dear friend Gaius, whom I love in the truth." Now, I got a bit of ribbing after last week's sermon for my emphasis on love and truth. But to be honest, I'm very comfortable with that because John loves it. And we'll see that this week. This week he's all about the truth, as we shall soon see. And it's worth noting in passing that here John gives love a location. He says love is located in truth. Actually, more specific than that, love is located in the truth. The truth, that is Christian truth, that John holds so dearly and so firmly. Now, I was thinking of English idioms, English sayings dealing with love. Things we might say in a letter, for old people among us, or in an email for middle-aged people among us, or in a TikTok video for younger ones. And I was looking for, where do we in English locate loves? We've got sayings like, "I love him to bits," which is an unusual thing to say when you think about it. I'm not quite sure. Am I in bits or are they in bits? Whatever. There's no location for these bits, as far as I can see. "I love her truly, madly, deeply." Has anyone ever said that, actually? If you have, come and see me afterwards, or if somebody said it to you, I'll be very interested to get the context. "Head over heels in love." Health and safety issues here, obviously. Or worse, "She takes my breath away," which could be a, criminal assault. But that's nothing compared to Bruno Mars, who will catch a grenade for you. So great is his love. And as the great Scottish comedian Kevin Bridges pointed out, should you really be going out with somebody that people throw grenades at? Is your location in a war zone? You need to think that relationship through a little bit. And finally, the even greater Stevie Wonder, "From the bottom of my heart." That's a lovely English idiom. And we get a location, "from the bottom of our heart." I'm not sure why the middle or the top isn't good enough, but "from the bottom of our heart" is the location for love. But that's not where John locates it. No. John locates love in truth. We're not messing around here with transitory emotions or passing feelings. No. This is solid stuff. "Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health." And this is an expression, this prayer is an expression of John's love. "And that all may go well with you, just as you are progressing spiritually." Which is great. Great to be prayed for, isn't it? Isn't it great? Every time I visit Joyce Pengelly, just up the road, she tells me that Kath and I and all our children, and even Auntie Eunice, are in her prayers. How encouraging is that to hear every week? John is encouraging Gaius. John is praying for Gaius's health, which is important, I think. This might be the sort of most significant of this sort of prayer in the New Testament, because we can be tempted to downplay the physical. And if you were here last week, you know there's a battle going on between a physical understanding of the incarnation of Jesus, and therefore an affirmation of all things physical. And we might be saying, well, we should only really be praying about the spiritual. Well, we'll get to that. But the physical state is important and suitable for prayer. And we regularly pray for those who are unwell among us, as we should. But prayer doesn't stop at well, at health. I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you. Everything. This is an all-encompassing prayer, isn't it? That all may go well. God is interested in our whole lives. And John reflects that here. And finally, last but not least, spiritual progress. Just as you are progressing spiritually. You know what's coming now, if you've heard a few sermons. Am I making spiritual progress? Are you making spiritual progress? Are we making spiritual progress? Is this church, McIntosh Church, a place where people come to grow? But what is spiritual progress? Is it reading our Bibles and praying more? The answer to every question in grown-up church, if the answer is Jesus in Sunday school. And the answer is yes, reading our Bibles and praying more are part of that, of course, amongst other things. But, and this is a really important but, those things are empty without producing real outcomes. We don't read the Bible for the sake of packing knowledge into our heads. We don't pray that we might clock up some time in our quiet time. No, we want these things, and God expects these things to produce fruit in our lives. And I want you to imagine, I know this will be very hard, very, very hard for all of you, but I want you to imagine that it was a bit of a struggle coming to church today. I know you've probably never ever experienced that sensation. But maybe life is getting on top of us. Old age saps our energy. The doctor is our closest friend, and the shadow of death begins to stand over our futures and dissuade us. Or maybe hectic life with work and kids and church and everything is just grinding the joy out of the Christian faith. Or maybe we just feel our grip on faith loosening as time goes by and faith beginning to slip through our fingers. And we woke up this morning and really didn't feel like coming to church at all. And yet, every one of us here got out our best hat, put it on, and came to church. And that is spiritual progress. Now, you might say, oh, you're trivializing faith, Alistair, but I'm not at all. Because the faith is not necessarily mighty explosions of glory. It's not all the Damascus Road. It's more often the steady rhythm of good choices. The NIV gives us a translation here, or at least the modern one version of it does, of spiritual progress. The ESV is maybe closer to what John actually wrote. It goes well with your soul. A little bit more old-fashioned, but I think more reflective of what John was trying to say. Coming to church today goes well with our souls. When I was a kid, struggling to give up smoking, I started when I was about 10. I think cigarettes were in old money when I started, right? It's a long time ago. By the time I was in my 20s, giving up was really difficult. Not because it's difficult to stop this cigarette. It's that this cigarette is not an event. It's not beginning here and ending when you put it out or flick it out the car window. No, don't do that if you're a smoker. But because each cigarette is part of a chain of things that you do. And not coming to church. If you said to me, Alistair, last week I couldn't come to church. I was just overwhelmed. I just needed a break. And I took a break. I would say, that's absolutely fine. That is absolutely fine. You wanted to recharge your batteries, a chance to rest, chance to reflect. That's absolutely fine. But we also know that abandoning church starts with one step. So if we came this morning when maybe much inside us resisted that choice, our very souls are in a better place. Maybe you've asked Pete Andrews for an Emmaus course book. Maybe you haven't, but you're going to this morning. That's good for the soul. Maybe you don't normally bring something to the family tea. Life's too busy and da-da-da-da-da. But tonight, you've got some Kit Kats. That's good for your soul. Not for our teeth, but for your soul, it's good. Maybe today you will offer a single prayer that you didn't offer yesterday. Don't worry about me. Joyce Pengelly has me well covered. Pray for the youth and children's workers out there right now with our children. Pray for Fan and for Coffee Morning and Minuscules. Pray for those getting on in years. Pray for our young people. Pray for the young families. Pray for the musicians who bless our worship here in Mac. Pray for the single people in Mac, living alone. That's not easy in an increasingly isolated society. Pray for them. Pray for Joyce, bedridden, but still praying. Pray for the trustees. They need prayer, decisions to make. Pray for the elders. They need prayer, guiding the church. People think it's easy, you know. Really? Pray for Christians in Iran and in Sudan and in Nigeria, persecuted for their faith, sometimes giving up their very lives for Jesus. And now the most important bit. That's a list I've just given you. It'd be lovely if you prayed for them all, but you don't have to. Just pray for one. Pick one thing. Take a small step. And today, that will be good for our souls. That will be spiritual progress. And if you want advanced spiritual progress, and I know there's a lot of advanced Christians here, how about picking one of the things that holds us back? Praying for that. The usual things: money, love of status and power, the distractions of materialism, the addictive power of greed, lust, and obsession, or the stuff that makes us feel better for the moment, the cigarette, but enslaves us for the future. The deep sins of the soul, the selfishness, the bitterness, the jealousy. Pick one and pray about it. Lord, help me to resist gossip and backbiting. Help me be more generous. And then couple that to an action. Maybe think through the topics of gossip and pick an alternative course for that conversation. And when it comes, we'll be mending our soul and the soul of others too. Of course, not all challenges are internal to our Christian lives. Oh, no, no, no. Our culture, our world is dead set against us. It hates us because it first hated him. And it will always be so. And it is a challenge under those circumstances to keep the main thing, because we're fighting on two fronts. We're fighting an internal battle and an external battle. Internal and external challenges to keeping the main thing, the focus of our lives. If our task is to keep the main thing, then for John, the main thing is rooted in truth. It gave me great joy when some believers came and testified about your faithfulness to the truth, telling how you, that's Gaius, continue to walk in it. John loves the truth, but he is also preparing a contrast for us, because not everyone in the church does love the truth. Tough, but true. And truth is visible. It's not something confined to a book or a sermon or a podcast or a YouTube video. You may find stuff about truth in those places, but truth in Christian lives is demonstrated in action. It's something we walk in. Our behavior, our Christian lives are grounded in walking in the truth. And truth is a path we walk, and it is a path straight and narrow. It's the path to life. We often forget that teaching of Jesus, that the welcome is wide, unlimited, universal. Everyone is called. It's a come as you are party. But narrow is the gate and straight the way that leads to life. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. Every parent here could say amen to that. John looks at Gaius and rejoices as a parent. How many of us would echo and applaud his words, especially for our children that are far off? And we surely forgive John a modicum of fatherly pride. Gaius, of course, is a spiritual child of John's spiritual work. And John probably had many spiritual children in the sense of being Christians, them being Christians who owe their introduction to the gospel to John, and probably much of their spiritual development too. Gaius has responded to the truth of salvation and now walks the walk of truth in action. Dear friends, you're faithful in what you're doing for the brothers and sisters. It's interesting. Here's what follows from the truth. What you're doing for the brothers and sisters, even though they're strangers to you. The Christian faith is universal in the sense that we are all children of God as believers and we're all welcomed into one family. And so mutual hospitality is part of the life of the church from the very beginning. At a time when communication was by hand-delivered letters. So if you want to write to somebody in Swansea, you write a letter and you give it to a man who's walking to Swansea, or a woman who's walking to Swansea. Or if he's very, very blessed, he's getting a boat. Communication is transported by believers. There's no post office from one church to another. And one of the basics was, therefore, the welcoming of those believers. A hot meal and a warm bed were vital signs of shared faith. And Gaius offers that hospitality and love to Christians who rock up at his church, even though they are strangers to him. He doesn't know them. He understands that the church is not a collection of individuals doing their own thing. No, it's a community, a connected community. It's a community of communities with churches, interdependent upon each other, so that Christians from Swansea can expect a warm welcome in Cardiff and vice versa. We love having Jim Probert here from Swansea, and we're going to have Phil Davis from Swansea here soon. And Gaius's welcome has become famous in the churches. They've told the church about your love. Please send them on their way in a manner that honours God. John is keen that Gaius ices the cake of hospitality. Send them out with a decent packed lunch, or more likely some cash in hand, or whatever they need. And here in Mac, we're visited by Christian workers, preachers and ministers. And we as a church bless them in a manner that honours God, as we should. You know, in verse 8, we ought to show hospitality to such people who rock up in the church, that we may work together for the truth. The Christian faith is about working together for the truth, not just here, but across the whole kingdom of God. And we've reached here a real point of warmth in the letter. And if John had signed it off there, we would have gone home completely uplifted with not a cloud on the horizon, because Gaius is running a good race for Jesus. And after all, the Christian life is described as a race. The Bible tells us that. And we are to run as if to win the prize, maximum effort. Gaius looks like he's all over that. But on the other hand, doesn't Jesus say, in the kingdom of God, the first will be last and the last will be first? How do we square the two, these two opposite tensions? Well, the key is in motivation. Why are we running, and who are we running for? There's no doubt about it. Gaius, he is running for his Lord. He runs for Jesus. He runs for the community of faith. However, if we're running for our own glory, then we're on the wrong track. And I've already lost in this race. And here John turns to the contrast at the heart of his letter. Sadly, not everyone is running for Jesus. I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will not welcome us. Gaius was the first of our goodies. Diotrephes, by contrast, is a wrong'un. And worse, he's a wrong'un in position of authority. He refuses to welcome John or Christians that are sent by John. He rejects the wider community of faith. He rejects welcome and love. He breaks that chain that joins Christians together. But what exactly is Diotrephes' problem? He loves to be forced. Now let's be honest, shall we? We all love to be first. I play badminton with guys as old as me as I am or older. It's an entirely social occasion. A bit of fun, except when it comes to winning and losing. Shouting, swearing, cheating, that was out. Recriminations, throwing the racket on the floor and marching off. I'm done with you all. Well, they'll be back next week. And I've seen it all. Because we really, really, really don't like coming second. There's a great essay on this by George Orwell about village cricket. Check it out if you can. Now you might say, but don't we have to leave behind selfish ambition when we become Christians? Oh yes. But would that was the case. We are all frail, mortal people. And for some people, a minority, the church is just another stage on which they want to perform. They bring to church the desire for the limelight of secular life, using the church as just a platform for their self-aggrandizement. The church for Diotrephes becomes just a different track, another court, another audience for his sense of his own status and importance, a place of personal glory. I'm sure if you spoke to Diotrephes, he would reel off his qualifications. I'm an elder, and I'm a leader, and I do this, and I do that. I'm a great man for God. He loves his personal glory. Contrast his behavior with Gaius. When Christians come carrying a letter from John the Elder, after all, one of the pillars of the church, and they bring the proof of their Christian fellowship and their belonging, he welcomes them, while Diotrephes bars the door. You guys are not welcome here. Why not? Why are they not welcome? Because they come from John. And John represents an authority that Diotrephes just doesn't have. He heard the words of Jesus live. He handled him. He lived with him. He walked with him through Galilee to Jerusalem to the cross. And to the resurrection. John is there at the birth of the church. John represents genuine Christian leadership, and Diotrephes, jealous of his position, rejects that authority because he loves to be first. He loves to be the one and only. And that brings me to eldership. And it's worth noting, Diotrephes is the only name mentioned here. He flies solo. There's only one name on the side of the baddies. He hasn't got the love and respect of leadership. Eldership has broken down in this church. One guy has grabbed the power and is steering the church wherever his whims take him. And that's a key reason why our churches feature shared leadership. Leadership is a team, and part of the role of the team, although we don't say so, is to restrain the ambition of the one. And this is a great example of what happens when someone declares himself to be the single figure of authority and forces his personal agenda on the church. This is the road to ruin. So when I come, John's coming, I'll call attention to what he's doing, spreading malicious nonsense about us. Spreading nonsense. John himself is going to get a grip. He's going to rock up and he's going to go public with the issue, which suggests that Diotrephes has been running a cover-up for some of the things he's been doing, but John will draw back the curtains and let the light shine in. Shine in on the nonsense of Diotrephes. Malicious nonsense, mind you. The nonsense was with a purpose. And his purpose is destructive. Destructive of John. Destructive of the church connected. And now the funny thing about nonsense, as we know only too well from fake news, is how readily it gets a hearing. Is that not the case? You'll never guess what that John's gone and done now. We can't trust these Christians with letters from John. No, we can't. They're not true believers. At least that's what Diotrephes says. Keep them away from us. And you can get away with that as long as no one has access to the facts. But the arrival of John, who comes with the truth, is going to change all that. Not satisfied with that, Diotrephes even refuses to welcome other believers. He also stops those who want to do so and puts them out of the church. How far have they fallen? He can't admit them or allow them to speak. His version of the truth, of course, if he does, will be revealed as nonsense. He'll stop at nothing to defend his lies. This is the very definition of heresy. The church being sacrificed on the ego of one man. Sad, sad stuff. And John, having outlined his sorry tale, wants to move back and end, thankfully, on the positive. Don't imitate what is evil, Diotrephes, but what is good. Gaius, focus on the good. And John has at hand an example of that. Demetrius, by contrast, is well spoken of by everyone. Look at his credentials. Everyone speaks well of him, even by the truth itself. We also speak well of him, John and his churches. And you know that our testimony is true. How fantastic is that? Even the truth itself. Scholars are not sure. That could be God the Father. That could be Jesus. That could be the Spirit of God. Take your pick. That's a commendation. In fact, some people think this letter is actually a commendation letter to Demetrius that he can take with him because he has been commended. And what I think is really interesting, and with this I'll close, it's the happy ending. The good man John commends a good man, Demetrius, to another good man, Gaius. And we began this letter in truth, and we finished this letter in truth. You know our testimony is true. You know it. John's life tells you that we know his testimony is true. Gosh, I wish people said that about me. The great George Orwell. In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. Do we live in a time of, well, if it's not universal, we certainly live in a time of deceit. Telling the truth in the gospel, telling the truth in the fellowship, telling the truth in and about our lives is absolutely revolutionary. John is a man who lives the truth and tells the truth. His word is true, and so may ours be as followers of God, the God of all truth.